Autumn would love to introduce you to Scale IP, the world's fastest growing IP commercialization software. Are you ready to transform your tech transfer office into a marketing powerhouse? Using proprietary IP transaction data, Scale IP helps you easily find high intent companies that partner or license with universities, gain technical fit insights, and launch personalized email campaigns with the right IP decision makers to save time, money, and effort. Don't let your innovations get lost in the shuffle. Right now, you can get a buy one, get one free offer when you sign up with promo code AutumnLove1 at www.scaleip.com. That's Autumn, love, the number one, at www.scaleip.com.
You're listening to Autumn on the Air, the weekly podcast that brings you conversations about the impact of research commercialization and the people who make it happen. Join us for interviews with patent and licensing professionals, innovators, entrepreneurs, and tech transfer leaders on the issues and trends that matter most. Keep listening for an inside track on the people, IP policies, and politics changing our world.
Welcome to another episode of Autumn on the Air. In today's episode, we're discussing intellectual property in the bourbon industry. This industry is a major economic driver for the region, with 95% of the world's bourbon supply made and aged in Kentucky. In this episode, we'll explore the critical role that tech transfer offices play in this space, from emerging partnerships with distilleries to licensed IP and startup companies. Joining us is Greg Tucker, a licensing manager and commercialization specialist at the University of Louisville. Greg's extensive experience includes negotiating business terms for license agreements, managing university technologies, and establishing partnerships between innovators and companies. He holds a doctorate in chemistry from Arizona State University and has multiple U.S. patents in renewable energy. Welcome, Greg. It's great to have you back on the podcast again.
Hi, Lisa. Great to be back on.
Yeah, and we have a really interesting and exciting episode today. We are going to highlight IP and bourbon for Bourbon Heritage Month. But before we get into all things bourbon, Greg, tell us a little bit about yourself since we've last had you on the podcast.
Yeah, definitely. I'm T. Gregory Tucker. I'm a licensing manager at University of Louisville, specifically the Research Foundation. And I work in the Office of Innovation and Technology Transfer. And also, I am the Diversity and Inclusion Pillar Lead for our HIPAA, our Kentucky Intellectual Property Association here locally in Louisville.
Wow, that's great. I know you're super busy, Greg, so we really, really appreciate you taking the time out to do this podcast with us. And I know bourbon came up at the Central Regional Meeting. Tell us a little bit and give us a little bit of a recap of how it came up at that meeting.
It did. And so glad to talk about this. I'm very happy to be here again and very excited to talk about this subject because we got a lot of good reception about it. And I think we might have created some more bourbon enthusiasts. So
I'm sure you did.
Right. And hopefully this will generate some more interest. So we haven't had the Central Region meeting here in 10 years, and the opening session is usually kind of a great introduction of people coming across the Midwest all the way from Minnesota, Ohio, as far as Louisiana, and we even had some people from overseas as well. A lot of people from the committee for the Autumn CRM committee, we actually pitched this idea to them. They like it, because it shows more of the economic drivers of what's happening right here in Kentucky. So a lot of people may not know this, but we actually had someone from the economic department come out that represents the multiple counties making the metro here and mention how not only we're a big manufacturing hub for automotive, appliance, and aerospace parts, but bourbon is one of the biggest industries here. It's a $9 billion industry. 90 to 95% of the world's bourbon actually comes from Kentucky.
Wow, 95%. I had no idea that that high of a percentage came out of Kentucky. That's really interesting.
Yeah, definitely. And it was good to have to bring in someone externally from the local municipality versus us as just tech transfer professionals kind of talking about it, because it was a great way to show how tech transfer intellectual property is applied to the local economy and on a global market as well.
That's really interesting, Greg, and amazing, tremendous economic impact. But let's take a step back for a second. And, you know, we hear about bourbon and whiskey, but I think we really don't know the history behind it. Can you share a little bit of the history of bourbon with us?
Sure. So I'm relatively new to Kentucky myself, been here 4 years. So I'm still novice, but I've learned a lot around hanging at the bars here with the different banter.
Doing research, of course.
Right, right. Had to do some on-hands research.
On-hands research.
And not only I'm a licensing manager, more in the physical science space. So chemical engineering, additive manufacturing, robotics. And I also have some bourbon-related technologies on my docket of the 200 to 300 different disclosures that we have. I have a handful of bourbon-related technology. So I started, like you said, Lisa, diving in, doing research during work and after work. And what I've learned is the history of bourbon goes far back. In fact, it goes far as back as George Washington, where not only was he the first one to sign off on the first patent, which is on the USPTO site, after his presidency, he ended up making a still. It was one of America's largest stills, more so rye whiskey, where I originally started in the spirits of rye whiskey. Later, more known here in Kentucky, they would probably say Elijah Craig is the one who made the first bottle of bourbon. Not so much distilling, but perhaps aging in barrels back in 1789. Definitely has his own bottle of bourbon that you can find in stores. And I would say from there, the history even goes back from there, where bourbon was being made throughout Kentucky and across the country as whiskey, where they had to make the Bottled and Bond Act, where there were different recipes for bourbon, and then some people are adulterating them, putting in dangerous chemicals, not only from turpentine, but even just spit for color, and where the Bottled and Bond Act came around and what that means. And first, I think I should start, what is bourbon? Because all bourbons are whiskeys, but not all whiskeys are bourbon, since I just kind of brought that up now. That what makes a bourbon is that the mash bill is at least 51% corn. So one of the grains, and that's one of the staple crops around here. And then from there, it has to be distilled and then aged in an oak barrel. And for it to be called straight Kentucky bourbon, aged at least 2 years minimum, and it can't enter the barrel more than 160, it can't be distilled at more than 160 proof and can't enter the barrel more than 125 proof. And the only thing you can add to bourbon is water. So after having your multiple grains, which is usually, again, 51% corn, barley, rye, and then sometimes there's a fourth grain, wheat. In fact, wheat is actually used a lot for flavoring. After it's distilled, that it's aged in a new white oak barrel, and the barrel is charred. It can be toasted, charred up to 1 to 4. And after putting your new make, the distillate, in there, it's aged, like I was saying, at least minimum 2 years to be called straight Kentucky bourbon. And it's actually that flavoring from the char that opens up the different sugars releasing in there. And it's sitting there at least 2 years, but you can age it much longer than that. Preferably, I like minimum 5 to 6 years, high is 12 to 15, but you can get bourbon aged much longer than that. And that's what makes its unique flavoring and different unique tasting profiles that we can talk a little bit more about. So those are the features of make a bourbon. Again, there might be some other requirements, but those are the more general ones. And to at least label the bottle that, because the labeling on the bottle is regulated. So now bottled and bond, it since there was so much adulteration of bourbon back in the early days, that to be bottled and bond, it had to be at least 100 alcohol proof, which is 50% alcohol. The grain and the distilling had to be in the same season by one distiller and aged 4 years minimum. And then also some of these distillers and rickhouses around here, a rickhouse is where they aged the barrels. They were locked by a government man. I think it was the IRS or one of these federal agencies. And they actually had a separate house where they only had the keys. Nowadays, I think people still follow those requirements, but I was just at a distillery. They even show the old house next to the rickhouse, but they don't have the government agents there anymore. And I guess just to come bring the history more up to speed quickly is that Prohibition happened between the 1920s and 30s that made alcohol making and selling alcohol illegal. But if people had their already private stash, from my understanding, they're all right. The families would go to different shops and you could to a pharmacy and buy medicinal bourbon, and everyone could buy a bottle, even if you're underage. And I know some distilleries were able to get that certification around here. Brown-Forman, I believe, is one of them. After that, really, since all the recipe and what makes bourbon a distinct American product, Congress in 1964 made it America's native spirit. And then from there, it was 2007 where this was declared Bourbon Heritage Month, and in September right now. And then after that, in the early mid 2000s, the bourbon boom happened, where there was a huge increase of people wanting to drink bourbon. And that's probably the latest that's probably happened since then up to date now. So hopefully that was a good quick rundown.
That was a really great timeline. And I was listening to an audiobook actually about the history of bourbon, and they were talking about, you mentioned George Washington. You can go to Mount Vernon and they have the still that he apparently used, and they are now, they're making some George Washington type bourbon that you can buy there. Apparently it's very expensive, but I thought that was very, very interesting.
I would love to try that. Try a presidential alcohol.
Yeah, exactly. So you've talked a lot, Greg, about bourbon in Kentucky. Where else can you find bourbon or whiskey being made? And where else is it popular to drink other than in Kentucky?
Okay, that is a really good question. And again, I'm not from Kentucky, but after being here, I thought only bourbon came from Kentucky. And now if you ask locals around here, you can make bourbon out of Kentucky, but if you want a good bourbon, it comes from Kentucky. So back to that that act, bourbon can be made legally and be called bourbon throughout the 50 states of the United States. I heard every state has actually made its own bourbon except for a couple. I think only Hawaii, from my understanding. And what makes, besides the mash bill I mentioned, bourbon is really as long as it's made within the United States. And outside of Kentucky, you definitely have Tennessee whiskey, which is basically a bourbon, but it has an additional process, the Lincoln process. It was developed with at the Jack Daniel's distillery, but which is getting a lot more attention now, Nearest Green, Uncle Nearest Bourbon, where it's an additional maple charcoal step that gives it its unique flavoring as well. So they call that Tennessee whiskey. And I would say outside of Kentucky, Tennessee, Indiana, a lot of the corn comes from Indiana, Iowa as well. A lot of the the barley and rye come from Minnesota, even Canada, but it's okay. Even some of the barley from Germany, I've been learning more, as long as it's, you know, distilled here in the United States and aged in the United States. And other popular states are also Ohio and New York and actually Colorado as well. Yeah, where some bourbons and whiskeys are made, and more states, but those are, you'll find more than one bottle coming from those states.
Yeah, we have some here in Illinois. You know, we have a lot of corn here in Illinois. And we have, it's a growing, I think, industry here in Illinois, for sure. It's getting to be more and more popular. I think a little bit easier than, we have a few winemakers who like to grow wine, but, you know, because of our climate here. So we're definitely seeing more and more whiskey and things like that here. So, Greg, what makes a bourbon a bourbon?
So it was kind of what I mentioned of the mash bill. So being 51% corn minimum, so it's usually three grains. So barley, it can be malted barley, and then also rye as well. And then which the rye makes a little bit sharper, so more of a spicier note. And then, or you could substitute it for wheat. I've seen a lot of that where wheat makes it a little bit sweeter, or you can have four grain and have all those grains in there as well. And really more so the mash bill, along with being aged in a charred new oak barrel as well. And then additionally, to be straight Kentucky bourbon, that barrel has to be filled no higher than the new make can't come off the still no higher than 160 proof and filled no higher than 125 proof in the barrel and aged for 2 years minimum within the Commonwealth of Kentucky, called Kentucky straight bourbon whiskey.
So we've been talking a lot about, you know, the history of bourbon, what makes bourbon a bourbon. Let's switch gears a little bit to talk about the role that IP plays, and what, if anything, does it have to do with bourbon?
Yeah, really good question. And this was the most fun of kind of how bourbon brings it all together, which was the name of our opening session at CRM, where bourbon and the spirits industry in general actually touch every aspect of intellectual property. It touches it from most recognizably the trademarks. So the names, the logos play a huge role, and even the value of the spirit, the bourbon. And not just in the spirits industry, but any industry where a lot of times you're paying for the brand, which can be, you know, 40 to even more than 50% of the cost that you're paying for. Also, copyrights. There's a lot of writing on these bottles as well. Bourbon has a tremendous history, being a native spirit. And when you go to your local bar, people will tell you all the stories about it. And again, it's an American spirit. So a lot of people's families are related to it, and they've written this stuff down. And some of this stuff has been registered with the Library of Congress as well. Also, you would have to say, besides trademarks, copyrights, but then also design patents. So I would say bourbon, outside of bourbon, tequila has some beautiful bottles, but bourbon has some very beautiful, distinct bottles. In fact, everywhere I go, if it's a new bar or a new state or somewhere out of the country, it's an eye catcher. So besides knowing a brand, if I want to try something new, just looking at the bottle alone that got my attention might allow me to end up persuading me to try that bourbon or whiskey. And those are the design patents, where they're based on the unique ornamental design of that bottle. And also, you also have utility patents. So utility patents have to have a functionality with its claims. And that's something I'll dive a little bit more to, because University of Louisville, our researchers have actually patented some of their innovative processes for processing different components of the bourbon industry, which I'll talk a little bit more about, but then also trade secrets as well. There is a lot of just technical knowledge, know-how within the bourbon industry that's been passed down generation to generation, that if it's not the proprietary blend of the grains, it's the distillation process. And then even when you age, when you put that new make, distill it in the barrel, where to put it at in the rick house on, you know, which corner, which height, where there can be a different maturation process for that bourbon to give it a different taste profile. The charring as well. So from being toasted, the chars go 1 to 4, which is a requirement for bourbon. There's a lot of trade secrets and the protection of those, that IP through trade secrets is huge as well. So that's pretty much every aspect of IP.
So, Greg, are there any particular IP-related cases involving bourbon that you could share with us?
Yeah, there are. Like I was mentioning, I have some bourbon-related technologies on my docket that have been patented. And not only learning about the research with my due diligence in that space, you end up getting exposed to the different IP cases that revolve around certain bourbons and distilleries. During our CRM opening session, where we actually talked about some of these cases with one of our local law firms, Stikes & Harbison, that has a spirits section. And the night before, we actually did a bourbon tasting there at their law firm with one of my local bartenders from the Louisville Thoroughbred Society, where she does her own bourbon tastings and giving the history of this called Bourbon with Afton. So some of these cases from both these groups, one of them more recently, people might have heard of Jack Daniel's versus VIP Products, where it was a parody piece of a plastic dog chew toy that resembled the Jack Daniel's bottle, looking a similar brown color. And Jack Daniel's is definitely known for its distinct bottle design, but then also the black and white labeling that kind of looks kind of old English. But then even further on the bottle, Jack Daniel's is known for old recipe number 7. And on this dog chew toy, it had a dog and it said the old number 2. So it was a little bit disparaging. And it seemed Jack Daniel's wanted to kind of protect their image from anything that could be harmful to their product and that could hurt sales at the end of the day, or just their reputation. I would say another well-known case is Maker's Mark, and maybe not so much the case is well-known, but definitely Maker's Mark Red Signature Wax that drips from the top of the bottle down the neck. And with that dripping wax down the neck to the bottle, it's Maker's Mark's distinct branding that is very recognizable and definitely to me. Some people actually notice the dripping wax before they even know the brand Maker's Mark, and they had won a big case at the time when they were a smaller distillery against a behemoth like Jose Cuervo Tequila at the time about the dripping wax. I think some of the more unique cases and more kind of personal, but you can see how this is business, is one of the bourbons that we tasted was called J.W. Dan. And it's a budget bourbon or bargain bourbon, they call them. It's great bourbon, but it's owned by Heaven Hill. But some of these originators of these distilleries, they go back generations and it's their family names like Beam, Brown-Forman, and in this case, J.W. Dan, where they started a distillery, some of the family members, because they wanted to start a distillery, and it's called Log Still. And they actually opened a tasting room. One of their bourbons is Monk's Road, and I went over there, and I saw the name was Dan. And one of the people there, they were like, well, yeah, we tried not to talk about that because it can be kind of sore, where at one point, it was a legal dispute where that trademark and the family's name, they couldn't even use their own name. But from my understanding, they came to an agreement, a mutual agreement to where the family could use this name for Logsteel as long as they make it distinct how they use the respective name, family name for it. But I'm pretty sure there might have been some kind of licensing behind that, perhaps. But that's a very interesting case as well. And then there's a lot of issued patents and applications just around the pot stills, the columns where the alcohol is evaporated and distilled through that can help for higher efficiency, even barrel stays for increased surface area to age the bourbon or bring out more of the sugars to have a better tasting profile. And more recently, I've even seen some technology to make the aging process faster. So reducing it from years to weeks.
You know, that's really interesting, Greg. And I want to turn now to some of the exciting innovations that are coming out of there at the University of Louisville that relate to bourbon. And I know one of them involves a company called Bioproducts LLC. Can you tell us a little bit about how this company originated out of Louisville and talk to us a little bit about some of its patented technology?
Yeah, so Bioproducts is a company that slightly predates me. I've been here at University of Louisville 4 years, but it takes that long for companies to take this nascent technology and further develop it. So Bioproducts was started out of our Conn Renewable Energy Center, since this is a patented innovative technique to help with sustainability purposes in the bourbon industry. And it was done by Professor Jagannath Saivoli, which is affiliated with our Speed Engineering School. He has a patent family that covers not only compositions of matter, but then also methods, and also penetrating not only different sectors for the bourbon industry, but then also biomass in general for sugarcane and any other unedible organic waste products as well.
Very, very interesting. And so, Greg, tell us how Bioproducts transforms organic waste from distilleries into value-added products. Share with us, if you can, a little bit of the process involved.
Yeah, definitely. So since we're talking about the bourbon industry here, this company, when I first got here, they actually won the Distillers Reverse Grain Pitch Competition. It was different companies from not only around Louisville, but across the country that wanted to take the stillage. And what stillage is the organic grainy waste matter left over from the fermentation process. That for every 9 gallons of this stillage, there's 1 gallon of bourbon made. So some of that stillage is kept, it's called sour mashed, where again, there's proprietariness in that mash bill, and they put it with, they keep it over for making more bourbon and kind of keep that same flavor profile. And the rest of it, they get rid of it. And it's around only what I think 10% is actually the grainy spent grains left over, and the rest of it is water pretty much. So what's more so known is kind of evaporating that water, and it's called animal feed, or it's kind of left over, where they also call it distiller's beer, where it's a small percent of alcohol left in there. You evaporate it and they actually feed it to the animals. So I think the animals might like that little kick, spirits kick in there as well. So
probably do.
And that's the most well-established known product for it. And he ended up not only he can produce that as well, but then also he extracted a substitute sugar in there, xylose, which is kind of well known, and to make it as a healthy alternative for the healthcare sector and dietary purposes. In fact, our executive director, Laura Savosky, that you're familiar with, she actually took some of his xylose sugar and made bourbon balls, which is another kind of delicacy around here. especially during the Derby, to have that with your bourbon. At most, I've had it in my coffee, and it's not too bad. It's definitely a healthier option, but it also gives it a unique taste, different from typical sugar. So he's definitely further developing that. But then also he has multiple products that he's working on. Another one is called BioCole. This product is where you further evaporate, again, the water and compact it into where it is the equivalent to a fossil fuel based coal that we're kind of typical of, which is definitely a staple of an economic driver here in Kentucky. He's actually partnered with some of these coal mining facilities to where this BioCole could reduce carbon greenhouse emissions of CO2 by up to 2/3 when burned, and which can burn still equivalently as traditional coal. So that product is being further developed. Another product where we're so used to additive manufacturing, 3D printing, a lot of that is that polymer, and those products that usually come out from 3D printing are usually that the plasticky type products that you get, where he's been able to, in a proprietary way, add some of this spent biomass, which can, you know, be the stillage or anything else from organic waste. And he's actually made these little prototypes of kind of organic, natural filling 3D printed products now. So he has multiple products at different stages of development. And even what helped him win that reverse pitch competition here in Kentucky, he can even extract a pure high surface area carbon. Why is carbon important? Carbon plays a big role in lithium ion batteries as one of the components in there for the charge and discharge purposes for ions. And again, Kentucky is a big manufacturing hub, and we have automotive plants, and electric vehicles are starting to play a bigger role here ever since the announcement by the government a few years back. So the main products, again, are already established on animal feed. His unique patented processes are extracting xylose, a high active, high surface area carbon, making BioCoal, and then also a filament for 3D printing as well. So a lot going on, and we're working with him closely, not only our office of tech transfer, but then our new ventures department dealt with the commercialization development, getting investment, since he already has a pilot plant near the university campus, and see how much further we can scale from here.
So, Greg, I think one of the things I found interesting about bioproducts is they also collaborate with farmers to help them increase revenue through biomass valorization. Tell us a little bit about how they work with farmers and the impact on farming practices there in Kentucky.
Yeah, that's a really good question, because not only do the distilleries play a big role, the bars we kind of mentioned as well, but then also the farmers as well, with our local agriculture. So from grain to glass, as we call it, from the crops, the corn, the different grains coming from the different fields throughout the region here and in Kentucky, that the farmers play a big role with not only growing the grains, but then also receiving, you know, full circle, recycling, repurposing. So this stillage can again be used as animal feed, but then also when that's a sustainable method right there, bringing that organic waste matter back to the farm. But then also how farmers can minimize the use of water, but then also figure out using ag tech. And those are other different patented technologies or methods to reduce water use, footprint of where some of these crops are being grown with vertical farming, and other methods that are starting to become more prevalent now, and see how it can make this industry more efficient as well. And not just for bourbon, but just for food and the local market as well. So one thing, we actually had our counterpart. So I was the co-site chair for CRM with my counterpart at University of Kentucky. And they actually started the Estate Whiskey Alliance. And with that alliance, they're trying to working closely with their Jim Beam Institute for learning distillation processes down there in Lexington, that it's an opportunity to see how they can make this industry more efficient, because there's a lot of water use. There's a lot of heat that is generated. So during fermentation, CO2 comes off, which is a greenhouse gas, but then also heat is generated. So how they can do multiple things to kind of recapture, repurpose some of that energy expenditure, minimizing it, but then also some of those organic waste products that we mentioned as well. So working with the farmers is, I know one of the requirements is seeing how you can minimize your water usage, since water is definitely important. But then other techniques that can make it more of a sustainable process, where that Estate Whiskey Alliance is working with some of those farmers to kind of, and distillers to kind of hash out some of those pain points and make it a certification that distillers, farmers that can slap a sticker to indicate on the side of their products as well.
So, Greg, that was really interesting, and it leads me to ask you, how does bioproducts balance economic viability with environmental sustainability in its operations?
Yeah, so besides trying to reduce the use of water and other materials, like I was mentioning, make it more efficient, they do want to start using, in the future, carbon credits as well. We've seen some other major players in different industries trading carbon credits. So that could definitely be helpful. Besides the different products that I mentioned that can make it a healthier substitute for patients or consumers. But then also protecting consumers, where some of these products are less energy intensive, less footprints when it comes to land. And then also better air quality, reducing greenhouse gases such as CO2 as well. And in fact, bioproducts recently won a renewable energy award that was showcased in a magazine not too long ago of them with their sustainable practices, using their patented technology and then further developing their technology, partnering with big distilleries like Angel's Envy, Rabbit Hole, Brown-Forman, other groups around here, and local farmers where those distillery has contracts with them, to show overall that they're making an impact within sustainability within this hundreds of year old industry with bourbon.
So given all that, what challenges is bioproducts facing, I would imagine, in terms of scaling up its sustainable technologies, and how are they trying to address some of these?
Right. So bioproducts right now is what we call when it comes to these patented technologies, and just kind of starting from the beginning when I first received this case, is from a technology readiness level, which is on a scale from 1 to 9, which is based off the DOD and NASA type scale. I even say 0 because 0 is just an idea, but 1 is actually kind of formulating that idea to 9, where it's a finalized product or service, where universities, and at least our office, we try to patent around a 2 or 3. So there's some preliminary experiments done that support a patent application. From there, we've already gone through the PCT and nationalization stages. And in tandem, besides the patent prosecution, commercialization is very important. And you have to move at the speed of business. So once they had their proof of concept, they've demonstrated at different pitch competitions. They've actually been voted as one of the local startups to watch here in the Commonwealth of Kentucky. And since the patent clock doesn't stop, we've been moving faster and faster, where he's found different partners, sub-licensing within different companies through the lower United States, but then also finding different partnerships with other countries where we have patent protection in those foreign jurisdictions as well. So very important to make sure that we're protected. And now you ask me, besides the TRL level, which now with those various products vary from, I would say, from a 5 to an 8. Some of them are sample sets that are being distributed now. And right now we're crossing that chasm, as they call it. So we thank the early adopters, and with Professor Jagannath licensing the technology from the university, since he is a co-inventor with multiple co-inventors from the university, but finding external partners as well, helping on the business side. Again, working closely with our new ventures team, where they're helping him get his corporate structure together for private investments. But then also we send them grants for SBIR, STTR grants for different funding opportunities. And along that way, he's very close to now just getting to be a finalized product, and consulting services as well with bioproducts here locally in Kentucky.
Really very exciting. They've got a lot going on, and they seem to be doing very, very well. So I want to switch from talking about bioproducts, Greg, and just to ask you, you know, you have a lot of experience now managing IP in the bourbon industry. What would you say are some of the common challenges that you've run across, and how have you addressed them?
Really good question. And again, my docket is mainly physical science related, chemical engineering, chemistry department, additive manufacturing, robotics, software. I even have some compounds at the Brown Cancer Center. This is definitely one of more of the exciting spaces. And I would even say one of the more older spaces, and then a lot of nuances around it as well. One of them in particular is working with different professors. I actually work with other professors besides Professor Jagannath, who actually has patented technology, licensed from the university, developed past proof of concept, has a pilot site, and is distributing sample sets for validation. I'm working with other professors now to de-risk some of their research. Some of them are trying to make some of these processes faster for distilling. And one of them in particular, Professor Stuart Williams, no relation to Evan Williams. I even asked him that. He's not related to that bourbon family. But he's actually has some research where, since we're talking about trademarks, one of the biggest pain points in the bourbon industry, Jack Daniel's is Tennessee whiskey owned by Brown-Forman, which is, Old Forester and Woodford Reserve here in Kentucky, that Jack Daniel's is one of the most world's known whiskey, and illegal and counterfeit products is huge with them. So a lot of times the bourbon industry and whiskey industry are these old traditional ways of people just knowing who their source is. It's an old traditional trusting route of people knowing who they are, where they're getting their product from. Back in the day, like when it was bottled and bond, it used to have different tax stamps on it. And then also other countries are kind of doing that as well. Like tequila, since I brought up tequila, mezcal, other countries actually put different stamps to show the authenticity of some of their products, where those are really just qualitative methods where, you know, at the end of the day, you won't know until you open that bottle and you know, drink that bourbon or that whiskey. And one of our professors found a quantitative method where he has a a sensory detection method where he can take a drop of bourbon or whiskey, and it's comprised of, you know, basically, you know, water and ethanol, the active ingredient, gets us inebriated, where once you evaporate all that, leftover residual grain leaves a distinct pattern on there, a fingerprint, you can almost call it. And he can identify the type of bourbon or whiskey it was due to that unique grain pattern that it leaves, that fingerprint, which is a great quantitative method to kind of quickly figure out if this is the good stuff or not, if it's real or not, counterfeit or not. And right now we're working diligently with him. We actually had a chance to present some of his research and Professor Williams and Professor Jagannath at, we did an IP and bourbon event with our KIPA, our Kentucky Intellectual Property Association, in conjunction with our United States Patent and Trademark Office, Midwest office, since we're part of the Midwest region. And so people came down from Detroit. We kind of, same way we kind of did our CRM event, we did something similar down here. And supposedly we're the first ones to do an IP at bourbon event with the USPTO. So that was great, and looking forward to doing something similar as well. So that's some of, you know, besides bioproducts, Professor Williams' work, and also Professor Tick, some of his work that he's doing in speed engineering as well. That's more so my bourbon related technologies. And besides working with different distillers here locally, I've actually done a bourbon tasting with one of the law firms that we did pre CRM, and I actually done a bourbon tasting in New Orleans, where we actually partnered with one of the law firms that we worked up here in Kentucky, down in New Orleans in Autumn a few years ago for the annual meeting as well. So I'm definitely starting to have this be not only work, but a hobby as well. So it's definitely been fun.
That's kind of neat when you can kind of mix the two, right? Where, you know, there's kind of a blending of work and hobby. So I think that's really neat. And Greg, as we come to the end of the podcast today and we wrap up Bourbon Heritage Month, what's your bourbon of choice?
All right. This is the hardest question of the night. So before I moved out here, I moved here from Arizona, and I was a rye whiskey drinker. And one of my favorite rye whiskeys is 291 from Colorado Springs. And it was at one point the number one rye whiskey in the world. But after moving here, because rye, I think, and I could be wrong, compared to other spirit enthusiasts, is more dry, kind of peppery, definitely different notes here. But bourbon has a whole spectrum of a profile, from fruity to floral to chocolate to woody, and all sorts of notes that you can imagine. And I would have to say right now, one of my favorite is Colonel E.H. Taylor small batch bourbon whiskey, bottled in bond preferably.
Wow, that's really pretty specific. I'm assuming that's something that's very local to Louisville?
Yes, it is. In fact, if you don't mind, because I would love to hear your favorite bourbon too, I can tell you one last IP story around this.
Yeah, definitely.
So I actually had to go to Lexington for a Kentucky Manufacturing Innovation Summit. And you can throw a rock around here and hit a distillery or a rickhouse. In fact, we're outfacing office, and our office is downtown. I actually park next to a distillery every day. I walk past, if I walk home, probably past three of them on the way home. And so I've had my chance to do a different tasting with them. Well, I was in Lexington, and this is about an hour and a half from Louisville. In fact, bourbon, where I mentioned, comes from Louisville, Lexington, Frankfort, and smaller areas throughout the bluegrass regions of the Commonwealth of Kentucky here. And it was E.H. Taylor, who's the one who's supposed to industrialize the bourbon industry. In fact, back then, when I was just mentioning Bottled and Bond, people stood by their name. So if you ever get a bottle of E.H. Taylor, which can be kind of rare and can be kind of pricey. In fact, I still want to get the single barrel one day, which is bourbon just from one aged barrel, and a small batch can make up, you know, 20 to the double digits of barrels versus their standard batch. So what's unique about this is that he would sign his bottles when he was selling it, and he has a unique cursive signature on it. And that kind of guaranteed that if you buy this bourbon from me, this is authentic bourbon whiskey of his standards. And he went in partnership with George Stagg, and Stagg is another well-known bourbon, part of the Buffalo Trace family that he, and in fact, it was come to find out from my understanding, E.H. Taylor actually started OFC, which is Old Copper Factory. I could be wrong, but it's a very well old bourbon. And E.H. Taylor started it. He got into financial trouble, and that's a lot of times that would happen. And he ended up selling the business, the distillery, to Stagg, who ended up running it. And a lot of times, you know, people can take that for granted. The OFC and his signature went kind of with the business. And from my understanding, Stagg even opened up the business in E.H. Taylor's name and still was using the trademark. You can go online where there's multiple cases. It was a case that was fought for like decades to where E.H. Taylor, I think he was able to finally get his name back, or there was some kind of agreement to it. But now E.H. Taylor, they end up falling out as businessmen and friends. But now E.H. Taylor should be now under the same company, Buffalo Trace, with Stagg as well. I have to double check that, but, you know, to hear about all that, you know, the industrialization of bourbon, the IP and trademarks around it, to where these two men didn't like each other anymore. And now the bottle has the cursive signature on it. And now they're under one roof with one distillery or company now. It's kind of
ironic, isn't it?
Right.
Yeah, it's very, very ironic. So
yeah.
definitely. So for me and my friends, Candy and Kevin Koenig actually introduced me to Angel's Envy. So that's the one I actually like. You've probably had that. It's a little hard to get here in Illinois, and they have their stash of it. And they were kind enough to share some with me. I got to try some. So I really enjoy that one.
That is excellent choice. That is, in fact, I have family from Chicago visit me here, and I took them to Angel's Envy, and that's near our office. If you're ever down here, Lisa, I'll have to take you there sometime. And that's what's so interesting about bourbon. A lot of families are involved, and I'll just say this story real quick. The Brown Forman family, the distiller left, and he started a distillery with his son, Wes Henderson. In fact, I had a chance to meet him at Louisville Startup Week a couple of years ago. And they started that distillery where they have a finishing process. So not only do they make the bourbon the traditional way, but then they take that bourbon after it's been aged and age it in a secondary barrel, which is usually a wine barrel or a rum barrel. Angel's Envy, it should be wine in particular. And it gives it even a sweeter finish on it. And they call that finishing. And there was even controversy if they're still going to call it a bourbon or not, you know, around that. But that's another innovative process when it comes to bourbon.
Very, very interesting. Yeah. So, you know, this is a first on the podcast, Greg. You and I have my Angel's Envy, and then you have your bourbon. And we're going to sign off the podcast today, each toasting bourbon.
Okay. I got a couple questions for you now, Lisa.
Sure.
So that is a great choice of a straight Kentucky bourbon whiskey. Kind of curious, how do you like drinking your bourbon? Preferably in a cocktail, on ice, or neat, or sometimes out west we call it straight up?
I like mine straight up, although I do have to say I do like it with a little bit of ice in there occasionally. I know if you add some water into it, it also helps open it up, and I've played with that as well. So how about yourself? How do you enjoy it?
Yeah, really good point. I actually prefer my bourbon neat, depending the quality of it. So this Colonel E.H. Taylor small batch bottled in bond. So that means it's minimum 100 proof. So I like it coming in hot. and for this brown delicious juice, I like to taste all the notes in it first. And then I'll add a little bit of maybe a drop of water or two just to help it blossom. Like you said, separate the oils, and you can taste some of those notes in there a little bit better.
It really is amazing how a drop or two of water with bourbon can make a difference. It really is interesting.
Yeah, definitely. So I just got done pouring me a dram.
I have mine too. I have a very small little glass compared to yours. I know our viewers can't see this, but yours is definitely a bigger glass.
Hopefully you can see my bottle here and the E.H. Taylor and maybe the signature, the cursive signature
yes.
on there.
Yeah, it really is really pretty neat how it has a signature on it. So are there anything else that people should know before they imbibe on bourbon besides maybe a little bit of water? Any particular types of glasses or anything else based on all your experience and research? Because we've learned throughout this podcast, you've done quite a bit of research, Greg, that you think listeners should be aware of.
Yeah. And I guess class is in session for happy hour now. I would have to say having a Glenclaren glass, which is a great way to nose your bourbon. So with me being in Kentucky and you in Chicagoland, I can walk us through a traditional Kentucky bourbon tasting.
Go for it.
All right. So I just poured myself a neat shot as well. You did too. It looks like you have something similar to a Glencairn. So that's good for the nose. We're definitely not going to shoot it. So we definitely, first thing is swirl it around, kind of take in the color if you can put it in some light and see what kind of amber color it is. And that's really a good sign too. I like a dark amber color, preferably. If you swirl it around, depending on the viscosity, you can see some of that bourbon crawl down the sides of the glass wall. And they call those legs
definitely.
Or roots sometimes. And I notice usually bourbons are usually between 80 and 90 proof. And I like it less than 110 proof. And I like to have more of those legs on there. So now we'll nose the bourbon where you kind of hold your mouth slightly open. And you, like that, take it from nostril to nostril and kind of inhale. Oh, that smells good.
Yeah. And it's interesting. You do get a different smell if you have your mouth closed versus open.
Definitely.
Because I just tried that.
Definitely. That was one of the first things I learned down here. And then from there, since we've swirled it, sniffed it, observed it, now we can taste it. And it's called the Kentucky Chew, where you just take a little bit.
Kind of swirl it.
Yeah, swirl it around your mouth a little bit. And I actually let it swirl on my tongue and let it fall on the top of my tongue down to the bottom. Because, you know, different taste buds and everybody's palate's different, but you can taste different aspects of it. But I like that creaminess, that syrupiness, that texture. What bourbon has being from corn syrup of coating your tongue. And then from there, and I'm actually going to take another sip. Where now after swallowing it, this is the back end, the finish, they call it, where you can just taste that vapor back there. And and that's the most lingering part. And that's so my two favorite parts are actually the nose, since I'm a slow sipper. And I like swirling my drink around and smelling it, the floral fruity notes on it. And then also the back end as well, where it kind of lingers a little bit more. And even though with this being 100 proof, I find it so amazing. And I've had bourbons coming in hotter than this, where how smooth bourbon is drinking it neat, where you might get that Kentucky kiss, or if it's a little bit harsher, the Kentucky hug, they call it. But it's excellent.
Well, this has really been such a great experience, Greg, not only having the opportunity to learn all about what's going on in bourbon and Kentucky, the interplay between or intersectionality between bourbon and IP, and then finally for you to walk us all through a bourbon tasting. Thank you so much. This has been fantastic.
This was great. Glad we could meet up again. Looking forward to meeting in person where we can actually toast. But thank you for the virtual toast.
Yes, exactly. And hopefully with our listeners, we'll be able to do some actual in-person tasting at the Autumn Annual Meeting coming up in March.
Yeah, who knows? And I guess last thing, if anyone has any questions revolving around some of these IP cases or just some resources about bourbon whiskey, you're more than welcome to reach out to me on LinkedIn.
Thanks so much again, Greg.
Thank you. Cheers.
Thank you, Greg, for joining us today and sharing your valuable insights into the intersection of intellectual property and the bourbon industry. It's inspiring to hear about the innovative work being done by Bioproducts LLC and the significant impact it's having on sustainability and economic development. To our listeners, I hope you enjoyed this episode and gained a deeper understanding of how IP and tech transfer are driving innovation in Kentucky's bourbon industry. Until next time, cheers.
Thanks for listening to Autumn on the Air with Lisa Mueller. Get social with us and share your thoughts. You can tweet us at AUTM or visit us online at AUTM.net. We'll be back next week on the air. Be sure to join us.